The book of Esther really should be read as a whole. It's almost impossible to break in and to finish reading in Esther. Wonderfully crafted narrative, but we, for time's sake, do need to break into it in chapter 6. But I would urge you to go home and just read it in one sitting. It's a thrilling read. That night, this is the night when Haman had gone home to his wife and friends, and they advised him to have Mordecai executed. And it was that evening that he agreed to that and began work on the gallows. It was that night that the king could not sleep. So one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers, who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Then the king said, "What honour or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's servants, who attended him, said, "Nothing has been done for him." So the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. The king's servant said to him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king asked him, "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honour?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "Whom would the king delight to honour more than me?" And Haman answered the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honour, let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honour. Then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honour.'" Then the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robe and the horse, as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who sits within the gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken." So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square, and proclaimed before him, "Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honour." Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him." While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. So, I've basically just given you my notes for tonight. They're written reasonably full. The reason for that is because this is going to be not structured as a sermon as such. It's going to be more of a lecture in a way, just to give us some background, some overview content, to help us as we begin our studies in Esther. And indeed, I hope it will be a little companion to you, to help you when you read the book at home, so you can maybe see some of the themes and see what's going on. The book of Esther is a wonderful book. It's skillfully written, full of intrigue and action, peril, victory, and there's a lot of humour, as you will have just noticed in that chapter 6, full of humour. You might say, well, where is the humour? I noticed a couple of chuckles. We learnt just last week, didn't we, that God laughs at those who set themselves up against himself and his people, who conspire together against him. And really, in this book of Esther, God is inviting us, his people, to laugh with him at the futility of opposing God. And so we have here, especially as this book has been inspired, the way it's been inspired to be written, very well written. Right at the end, it gives you a few structures, the way it has been written, with great structure, beauty in the way it's been written. And it emphasises the foolishness. We'll come later on the character studies of the book, that Ahasuerus is like a buffoon. He's portrayed as a buffoon in the book, and we're supposed to laugh at them. We're supposed to laugh at Haman, his futile attempts, and basically falling into his own pit. And so we will start with the setting of the book. The setting. When was this story taking place? We don't actually know when it was written, but it would suggest that it was written either at the time or very, very shortly after the time. He was obviously a Jew, interested in Jewish history, one of God's people being inspired to write. And the person obviously knew the inner workings of the Persian court. It's suggested, and I think it's a very good suggestion, that it was quite possibly Mordecai himself that wrote it, but we do not know for sure. The place was Shushan. It's probably better translated Susa. It was the ancient capital of the Elamites. The ancient capital was destroyed in 1640 by the Assyrian Emperor Ashurbanipal. Some of his artifacts is in the British Museum, I believe. And then it was rebuilt by Darius I. And he made it the administrative capital of the Persian Empire. And then when Darius' son, which is Ahasuerus, this man who was the king at the time of Esther, otherwise known as Xerxes, when he took to the throne, he made Susa his winter residence. And the time was 486 to 465 BC. So this is the reign of Ahasuerus, and it happened at the beginning of his reign. Susa was a particularly impressive and beautiful city, we are led to believe. Some of the artefacts are in the Louvre, I believe, in France. But it was very similar, apparently, to another place beginning with P. Persepolis. Thank you, Persepolis. And there's quite a lot of digital reworking of that place, where you can go online and see that. But it was a beautiful place. It's situated in modern day Iran. In the year 480 to 479, King Ahasuerus sought to expand the borders of Persia. He wanted to defeat Greece and make that part of the Persian Empire. And for this, Ahasuerus made extensive plans. Some people believe that the planning took a number of years to make. And this has led some people to believe that these great long feasts that he held at the beginning of the book of Esther, these great 180-day feasts, was part of his planning when he was gathering all of his officials from all over his empire at different periods through that 180 days to plan his conquest. And it was in that time that he had that dispute with his wife Vashti. That campaign ended miserably for him, ended in defeat, and he came back licking his wounds, as it were, and it was likely at that time that chapter 2 is set. He'd just come home after a failed battle, was remembering his wife Vashti, wanting to comfort himself with his wife, and that's when we believe that he set about finding a new wife. The history books backs up the hapless kind of image we have of King Ahasuerus, who retired back to Susa in the seventh year of his reign. Herodotus, one of the historians of the time, backs that up and backs really what scripture says in the book of Esther. Now, the Persian Empire was a vast empire. If you just turn over, I've put a picture of the empire. Absolutely massive. I chose this picture because it had that little picture of the globe underneath it, which shows the vastness of the empire. It swallowed up Babylonia. It swallowed up Egypt. It swallowed up a vast array of land. And including that, when it overtook Babylon, it overtook Israel and Judah. When we need to think about this especially and bear in mind the vastness of this empire when we're looking at the threat that Haman makes later on in the book. That the threat of Haman and the decree that the king makes on Haman's behalf was to slaughter all the Jews in the Persian Empire. Now we know that when Babylon overcame Judah, the people were scattered throughout the Babylonian Empire. Previously, before that, in the Assyrian Empire overcame Israel, the Israelites were scattered through their empire, and now this Persian Empire swallowed them all up and more. And so when and even the Egyptian, even those that fled to Egypt at the time of Jeremiah, you may think, well, maybe some of those will escape. Well, no, it swallowed up Egypt as well. And so when this decree went out, if it had have taken place, it would have wiped out the whole of the Jewish race. That's how great a threat it was. The timelines then, I've just put in a timeline. This is estimated dates. I compiled this from various different sources to try and set in your minds when about this is. We have in highlighted in bold when I believe the beginning Esther 1 was, and then the rest of the reign of Ahasuerus. And that's really just for your benefit later on. So let's move swiftly on to the characters then. Ahasuerus, as I've said already, seemed to be a hapless leader. He's portrayed as a hot-headed, rash, but also seemingly weak leader. It would seem he needed advice on every decision that he made. When he couldn't control his wife, he had to ask his officials what he should do with his own wife. When he wanted to honour someone who deserved honour, he couldn't think about how he should honour this man. No, he had to ask someone else how to honour this man. He desired respect and honour himself, didn't he? Yet he couldn't even command respect and honour from his own wife. Extra biblical data seems to give us a very similar picture of this man. He was not a nice man at all. There is one story where one of his loyal men, I think I was going to say this later on in my notes actually, when one of his loyal men asked for him, for his sons not to go to war with him. And so rather than letting him off, or rather than saying no, you can have, they're going to have to go to war, he cut them in two and made his army march between them. He was a horrible man. And also we see in this book of Esther that he chose to, or he allowed for the decimation of a whole people group in his empire without even asking who that people group was. So quite a foolish man too. See that in Esther 3:8-9. So moving on from Esther then, from Ahasuerus, we can move on to Esther. Esther lends her name to the book, as you know. She was the daughter of Abihail. Forgive me for a typo there, I missed that out. Daughter of Abihail, the cousin of Mordecai. She was an orphan. Her parents had died and Mordecai had taken her in. Her Hebrew name was Hadassah, meaning myrtle. And Esther was her Persian name, meaning star. It would seem that those who grew up in Persia took on Persian names to assimilate to a certain extent the society around them so that they would blend in to a degree. Esther was an exceptionally beautiful young lady. And this, I don't think, just extends to her outward beauty, though she was particularly beautiful outwardly. She also endears everyone she meets. We see this going through the book as you read it. The eunuch who takes care of her, you know, gives her special treatment because she endears herself to him. She endears herself to the king so that the king would choose her and be delighted in her. And even when she goes into the king, unwelcome in many sense, hadn't been asked for, he didn't lose his temper with her. He held out the golden scepter and gave her a hearing. She endeared herself to Haman. He was very, very pleased that she would invite him to a feast with him and the king. But she was also a woman of great wisdom. She took the advice of Haggai the eunuch about what to take with her to the king. She shows great wisdom and courage in the way she approaches the king with the feasts and the way she seeks to win his affection before condemning Haman. And she was a woman of courage, wasn't she? She said, "If I die, I die." But she chose to go into the king. Some people question her morality of being in the running for being the queen, of Persia. Now, obviously, we don't know, but I suspect that she didn't have much of a say in it. There's no question of her integrity, really, throughout the book. Even Mordecai, her keeper, shows himself to be a godly man. So I would think that that wasn't really her fault. But the Lord used it, didn't he? Mordecai was a well-respected man in the citadel of Susa. He obviously took his role for caring of Esther very seriously. We read in Esther 2:11 that Mordecai paced up and down outside the lady's place, just worrying about her, wondering what was being done with her. He sought to live righteously, saving the king's life. And though Mordecai had not sought to go back to Judah, he obviously was concerned to keep his Jewishness. He didn't want to bow down to anyone but God. He was refusing to bow down to Haman. And he had great faith in God, in the promises of God, didn't he? When he was recommending that Esther goes into the king, he said to her, "If you do not, then relief will come. It will certainly come from some other way." But just one final thing to note about Mordecai is his lineage. Very, very important. They note especially, the writer notes especially, that he was a Benjamite and also a son of Kish. the writer is wanting us to think of Saul. He's picturing Saul. He's trying to link Mordecai with Saul. Now, the Kish that was his ancestor, I doubt, was the Kish of Saul. But he's certainly trying to bring that link. And we'll see why a little later on. Haman, then, our last character study, was the arch enemy in this book. He epitomises the enemies of God's people and God himself throughout the history of the world. As I've said, there was a special mention of Mordecai's lineage, and so there is for Haman. The writer takes special notice and interest in the fact that Haman was Agagite in Esther 3:1. Now, if you remember, Agag was the king of the Amalekites at the time of Saul. Saul was commanded to go to war with Agag. He was commanded in 1 Samuel 15:3, "Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." Sadly, Saul disobeyed the command of God. And so we have an Agagite carrying on the war against the people of God. You may ask the question, why did God command Saul to go out and kill, decimate the Amalekites, those of Agag? Well, it's because of the Lord's oath in Exodus 17. In Exodus 17, the Amalekites came out and fought with the newly liberated Israel, children of Israel. And they fought against them, and then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven." And Moses built an altar and called its name, "The Lord is my banner." For he said, "Because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." These pictured the enemies of God throughout much of the Old Testament. And so it is here, Haman, the Agagite, carrying on that war with the people of God. Haman himself was an ambitious, greedy, proud, self-seeking and despicable man, but at the same time showed great shrewdness and cunning in the way he manipulated the king to get what he desired. But ultimately, blinded by pride and hatred, his ultimate demise came at his own hand. And I think in that we see a wonderful picture of the cross of Christ. When Satan was thinking that he was dealing the fatal blow on the seed, he dealt the mortal blow against himself as Jesus Christ won the victory. And that brings me on to the theology and themes of the book. Some people have questioned the place of the book of Esther in the canon of Scripture, right down through history. Even Luther himself questioned it. That is because there is no mention of God in this book. There's no mention explicitly of prayer in this book. There's no mention explicitly of the worship of God in this book. However, though there is no direct mention, at a close reading of the book of Esther, we see God woven throughout. And indeed, we even see some of those other things mentioned too. Take, for example, prayer. Prayer is not mentioned explicitly, directly, but Esther calls upon upon the Jews to fast. And often, as you are aware, in the Old Testament, fasting is closely associated with mourning, confession, and as an aid to prayer. There's even times when of crisis. We have examples of when times of crisis, wartime leaders fasted in order to ask God's guidance and intervention. Worship also isn't mentioned directly either. But we also observe in the book that the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday, because of their victory or their impending victory. In chapter 9, the Feast of Purim is instituted. And though this isn't a feast that is instituted in the Torah, in the book of the law, nonetheless, feasts and holidays in the Old Testament always centre upon the worship of God and thanksgiving to him for his deliverance. Think of the Passover, for instance, and throughout the history of the Jews, right up until, until present day, right from that time, the Jews celebrated God's victory in the time of Esther. And finally then, the mention of God, the most important one. And though it is correct that God isn't mentioned explicitly in the book, he isn't named, we do see him showing his face, or indeed showing his hand of providence throughout the book. So why is God not mentioned directly? What are we supposed to learn from that? The writer could quite easily have mentioned God directly. Well, I think the main reason is because there is teaching in this book on what it is or how we should live in the normal run of life. We don't have special revelation from God speaking to us directly into every situation we find ourselves in. And in fact, there are vast swathes of time, even in the Old Testament, when they weren't having that special input from God, that special revelation from God, telling them what to do in every given situation. And so it is speaking to us how we are to live as exiles and pilgrims in a foreign land, amidst great opposition, in great peril, and yet without the direct instruction, direct revelation from God, just to have his word for our counsel and our guide. We see God's providence working through every situation. And though we cannot see God in every situation we find ourselves in, some of us may find ourselves in very difficult situations. Well, this book brings us comfort, because nor could they, and yet God's providence comes in and has the victory. And so that is the key, the main theme or theological theme of the book, divine providence. This book is written from the perspective of the people on the ground. It's not written from God's eyes, it's written from the people's eyes in exile. They would not have been able to necessarily discern God's work or his hand in a given situation. Just think, when the king was holding his banquet and called for Vashti when he was drunk, made a rash decision. When he made that rash decision to excommunicate her, they would have just thought, well, it was just one of those things. When Vashti threw away her position by not obeying her husband, they would have just thought, well, that was silly, but it was just one of those things. When Esther was brought into the palace, they would have had no idea what was going on. They may have been worried about Esther's position and what may come of her. And yet throughout all of that, God was planning. God was preparing, opening the way for Esther to come in. Esther coming in. And in all of that, they would have had absolutely no idea. In the same way with us, isn't it? Something tragic happens. Something difficult comes along. And we're in that situation, wondering what on earth is going on. And yet this book teaches us that God is in control, providentially guiding. I think we could see Esther as an Old Testament exposition of that wonderful verse of Paul in Romans 8:28. We know all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. The clearest times we have the sight of God's hand, I think, is in chapter 6. In those times of it just so happened. It just so happened that on that night the king couldn't sleep. It just so happened that when he could have had all manner of entertainment throughout the night, he chose the book of the Chronicles of his reign. Probably because they were so boring and he wanted to be sent to sleep. And yet it so happened that the book man or person reading that book flipped to that very page when Mordecai's exploits came up. It just so happened that inexplicably Ahasuerus forgot to honour this man. Now for one of the kings of the Persians, not to honour someone who had done them a good deed was unheard of. They would always honour someone who had done them good, who had worked for them good, because they wanted to encourage other people to do the same. And yet he forgot. And it just so happened when he went out to find someone to advise him how to honour this man, that in Haman's eagerness, excitement to kill Mordecai, he was the man that was there to advise. Such irony. And yet none of those things could have been orchestrated by any one of those people. It was God's hand working those things out. But though providence of God, divine providence, is the probably biggest key theme, there are some others also. And I think one of the other most important ones is the responsibility of man, written throughout this book. The providence of God is well counterbalanced by the responsibility of man. Throughout the book, because we do not have the mention of God, we view the people's actions taking action when they needed to take action. Ahasuerus was responsible for his sinful actions, and he would have borne the judgment for them. Haman was totally responsible for the wicked intentions and plans and schemes that he made, and he indeed bore the judgment for them. Mordecai, seeking to live an upright life, seeking to be obedient to the words of Jeremiah, where he said, "And seek the peace of the city where I have caused you to be carried away captive, and pray to the Lord for it, for in its peace you will have peace." And in obedience to that, seeking to be a good Jew, sought to take care of the king, to protect his life. Esther was totally responsible for her own actions, as she sought to be courageous, as she sought to lead the Jews in victory. Each one of them were responsible for their actions. They didn't have a direct revelation. They just did what they thought was the best thing, the right thing, that would honour God and would protect God's interests. And yet in all of this, though they were responsible, and we too are responsible for our own actions, the way we are to live out our lives, God works with all of that. He works with the good decisions, he works with the bad, he works it all out for his glory. But then that brings me to my final point on this. The two seeds. The two seeds is a massive theme in Scripture. We see the two seeds written right through Scripture, but especially in Genesis, 3 to 9 very clearly brought out the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. Then we see the godly line of Seth and the ungodly line of Abimelech, I think it is. We see the two seeds, the godly people, the ungodly. And I could have entitled this the two plans, because the two seeds have two different plans. We've got the plan of Esther, the plan for good, the plan for salvation, the plan of Haman, of destruction, of killing off the Jews. And they were just working out the two greater plans of God for ultimate salvation, and the plan of Satan for the ultimate demise of God's plan. We could have called it the long war, as David has been bringing us to and will continue to, I think. The long war emphasizes that long cosmic battle that has been raging since Satan has first stepped out of his proper domain, trying to usurp God. But that hasn't only been reigning in the heavenly places, has it? In spiritual places. No, it's been raging here on earth too. And so we see these two seeds. And as I mentioned at the beginning, if this plan had taken place, the seed would not have been able to come. God would not have been able to keep his promises. The Jews would have been decimated, and salvation would not have been accomplished. And so we read that, the way God is working out his wonderful plan throughout this book. And so, in conclusion then, how are we to live when it looks like God has left us? If you just glance up into a couple of paragraphs before, if you're reading through the notes, I've noted that it was at this time, or it was at the time of the cross, when Christ crushed the serpent's head. And yet even still he seeks to ruin God's plan and destroy God's people. I've noted we are in a war, and we are still in that war. And so how are we to live when it looks like God has left us, when everything is against us? Well, this book of Esther speaks directly to that, doesn't it? Jesus says, "My sheep hear my voice and they follow me." He also said, "If you love me, keep my commandments." We are to follow Christ and keep his commandments. We are to work out our own salvation with fear and trembling, looking only unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. There is man's responsibility, and there is God's sovereignty, the wonderful providence of God. What Oliver Cromwell is reported to have said at the opening battle of the English Civil War is very appropriate, I think. He's said to have said, "Put your trust in God, my boys, but keep your powder dry." Well, does Esther teach us that God helps themselves and helps only those who help themselves? I don't think so. Did Cromwell think that God only helps those who help themselves? I don't really know what he was thinking, but as much as I do understand Puritan thought, I don't think so either. But what Esther teaches us, what Cromwell teaches us, is that we are to seek to live our lives to the glory of God. We are to seek to make good decisions, wise decisions, before God. And yet we can trust him, because he will work all things out for the good of his people. So as we begin this study, as we begin these series through this book, get ready for suspense, get ready for drama, humour, peril and victory. But most of all, see the wonderful providence of God. I'd just like to leave you with Esther 4:16. When Esther says this, "Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." Well, I hope that has brought some light upon the book, as so often is when we do a big introduction like this. It's taken some time, so thank you for your patience, but I trust that